It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Meet Reverend Alex G. Like a lot of us, he's interested in his family history.
I've always been interested in genealogy. It's always intrigued me to know where my family name came from. My entire life I've been asked, where does G come from?
So he started digging around.
My great-great-grandfather was born a slave. His name was Henderson. And so about a year ago, I Googled his name and through Ancestry.com, and I found out that his father's name was Reuben Joshua G.
But here's the kicker. The relatives Alex G. found are white. He discovered that he's part white as well.
I found a post from a gentleman named John who basically said, I just found out that my great-great-grandfather had a black son. Does anyone know anything about Henderson G? And I thought, wait a minute, this is my grandfather's grandfather. And I wrote this guy about midnight. When I woke up the next morning, I had something in my inbox explaining who he was and who we were to each other. And that's how the discussion began.
And that discussion turned into a trip for Reverend Alex G. He and a couple of family members headed from Wisconsin down to New Orleans to meet his white cousin, John Harkin.
Roast beef gravy on those are like the specialty.
Oh, that's great.
That's good for as long as you eat it.
Did you know that the G's, before they ended up in England and Wales, came from France? The name was Guy, G-U-I.
So the roots were in France.
Yeah, it was probably before 1500. We know they were in England and Wales in 1500. There's the G Cross. That's a landmark over there.
Really?
Yeah.
If you were looking at G's American family tree, it'd go like this. At the top, the patriarch, Reuben G., plantation owner, slave owner. His first son, R.L. G., was born to his white wife. But his second son, Henderson G., was born to another woman, a woman he owned. And that son was born black and enslaved. Now, this story is not so unusual. Especially in the age of genetic ancestry testing, root-seeking is more popular than ever. In this hour, what are the consequences of discovering the history of slavery written in your own bloodline? Does it open the door to new questions about racial justice and social healing? Well, those are all questions Alex G. had in mind when he headed south to meet his white relatives. Charles Monroe Cain wanted to know what that was like.
You went down with your sister and your daughter, right?
That's right. And then one of my interns.
Yeah. So when you got there, all of you, what was it like when you saw your first white relative?
You know, Charles, it was surreal. I'm a public speaker. I'm always thrust into situations where I need to think on my feet. But I was nervous. We flew to New Orleans and got in about 10 o'clock Friday night. We Ubered over to his place that morning. I was afraid of what I would feel. Would it be awkward? Would he be distant? Would I be angry? When I walked up to the porch, he opened the door and he hugged me. He said, well, cousin Alex. And it's like this older white guy in his early 70s and hugged me and invited my whole family into his home.
So, after we eat, we'll go upstairs. We've got more coffee. We've got Coke Zero and Dr. Pepper.
You like the Dr. Pepper.
So, we'll take a drink break and go back and have another little session.
Yeah.
You luckily have audio.
Sure,
And I spent a good 6-7 hours listening to all of it.
My father used to tell me his father, who was Oscar, had a white uncle. We just thought he meant very fair skin. And he said they had blue eyes.
That would be our great-great-grandfather.
He talked about a guy named Thomas.
Thomas G. He would be our grandmother's brother. I've told Joan, I really think there was a silent conspiracy not to mention Henderson and what went on back when.
I bet.
I'll bet our grandmother knew.
I bet a lot of people knew.
Oh, they knew.
Do you know?
They knew.
The G's were old South plantation aristocracies. They had a lot of land, and they were living the more gone with the wind type life. They had the big home, and they had the silver that they hid in the well during the Civil War. And they held slaves, and there was Henderson born within this family, and right at the same time that Reuben was having his white children, then Henderson was born too. That is Beulah, and this is Robert Lafayette, who would have been Henderson's half-brother. There's a real relationship in terms of looks. I'm sure you see it.
Just the shape of his head and ears, hairline, it reminds me a lot of Henderson's photo.
Yeah.
Henderson was a slave.
Right.
His mother, Venus, was a slave. His father, Henderson's father, was her owner and his owner. I look at those photos and I think, how do you feel about your white bloodline?
That's the piece that made the trip surreal.
Mm-hmm.
Because my G name, and I'm proud of my name, and I work hard in the community. It's a reputable name. But my name comes from the gentleman who owned and raped my great-great-great-grandmother. And so I have to keep wrestling with that. The name I try to defend, the name that I try to redeem, comes from this Welsh slave owner, and that blood is in me. That's something I'm still reconciling. I'm still wrestling with.
I think that's
what kept my heart racing that entire day. We sat and we met. I didn't know how to reconcile the two.
You grew up with the pressures and the prejudices of being a black man in America, but now you're also white. Does that change your identity for you to know?
No, because this is American history. I don't know any African Americans who don't have white blood in them. I think what makes this so unique is knowing the people who are descendants. We have the same blood in us, but we have different stories.
John, how old are the homes in this community?
Most of these, like this one, was 1861. It's a great house.
These aren't 13-foot ceilings. That's at least like 15 feet.
13.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh, it looks higher.
It looks higher than 13.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I'm going to take you up to my library, which is really my favorite room, because that's where the real family antiques are.
It's apparent and clear how, not easy, but how much easier the white side of the G family had it after Reconstruction. Do you feel the black G's are owed something?
I think about that when I see road signs named G, and I see that it was a well-known name. I mean, G grocery store is sort of like the Quick Trip in that community. That's where people in that part of Leake County go for their groceries and gas, and then there's the laundry store next door. Then I consider the fact that my father was a sharecropper.
Yeah.
He picked cotton for a living. So I'm the only black male G to not pick cotton for a living, because my father did, his father Ernest did, his father Oscar did, and his father Henderson was a slave. When I had that meeting, I didn't think just that, wow, they're white. I'm thinking they're probably oblivious to U.S. history. To have built this wealth and these businesses and this ownership on the backs of black people, and to really think that the American dream has worked for them. They worked really, really hard, and they were probably more fortunate than us because racism kept us down. No, that slavery system and my family members kept us down.
Yeah.
So let me come back to asking you and John
sure.
a question. So what is this like for you, I mean, to actually be meeting family?
Well, I'm atypical, I think, I have to say, for the South and the whole family. You know, I grew up with parents who were just incredibly bigoted, racist. And I was the same thing, because as a child, you just parrot what you hear your parents say. I had my great moment of discovery about the time I was a senior in high school. Been a Yellow Dog Democrat ever since. So it's very fulfilling for me to meet you people. Find out we're just all folks and we've got a lot in common, much more so than I do with all of my white relatives. I mean, there weren't a lot of Hillary votes out there
sure.
In the family. They're all Trump people. So it's great to me. Open up this whole new vista.
I was waiting for something to happen that never happened, which was the white people bring up slavery, or at least to talk about how Henderson was conceived. They never brought up slavery. I was like...
Well, when do white people ever bring up slavery, other than to be sorry that it happened to someone else? I think to bring up slavery in the context of their family, to somehow connect their ability to have a formal education or the life that they do, I still don't know if they made the connection between who they are and how they became who they are. Mm-hmm. The wealth that was afforded them, the opportunities. I think, one, it's too painful. Two, it's too embarrassing. And it feels so, so distant. But I wouldn't have my last name were it not for slavery.
Right.
And so I never expected them to bring it up. And in the first meeting, I wasn't sure how ready I was.
So 2 days ago, just 2 days ago,
sure,
I called John Harkin up on the phone, your cousin. We only talked for like 10 minutes, but I'll play a little snippet of this conversation. I asked him this.
Sure.
Good morning, Harkins Flores. This is John.
John, this is Charles from To the Best of Our Knowledge. How are you, sir?
Okay.
Are you ready to chit-chat about family history?
I am indeed.
You met your G relatives that were descendants of Henderson G. How did it feel to meet them?
It was just a wonderful coming together. Beautiful people, and I had only heard a few months earlier of Henderson.
You and Alex G. seem to have connected, and you have such a powerful history together. Have you ever thought about what it'd be like if you had switched places? I mean, what if you were the descendant of Henderson and he was the descendant of Robert? Have you ever considered that?
I would be a very angry person.
Why do you think you'd be angry?
The injustice of it all.
I'm looking at the pictures, amazing photographs of Robert, your G descendant, and of Henderson, Alex's G descendant. And look at these two photos, and I can't help but just see pain and American history and privilege. When you look at these photographs now, how do you see these two photographs?
I see more the commonalities than the distinction. I don't, on the surface, see black, white as this irreparable chasm. When Alex and I sit down and we spent the whole day together, I found more commonality than a situation where people are not able to deal with each other.
Alex, Reverend G, what about you? Do you feel commonality looking at those photographs? You know, it must have been a moment driving back in the car maybe where you're like, oh, I wonder what it would have been like if I was a descendant of the other brother, of the white brother, and still a G. Did you even think about that?
Mm-hmm. I often think that if my accomplishments, I'm a published author, things I've started, created a nonprofit, created a movement, if I were white doing what I'm doing, I'd be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think that if I were R.L.'s great-great-great-grandson, given some of the resources that they were given, there are days where I would think, man, I could be a U.S. senator today. I could be the president of a university. And then I'll flip and think, but I'm only 54, and I'm Henderson's great-great-grandson, and I can still do that stuff and not attribute it to being white and privileged. I've got something inside me that's allowed me to catch up. My daughter's a preemie. And the nurse told us to sort of watch it because preemies always feel the need to catch up. Like they know that their development is delayed, but there's an internal mechanism that just makes them just want to catch up, crawl, walk, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like a cultural preemie, like something inside me just looked around and said, you know what? I got to be the fastest. I got to be the strongest. And I've got to show that what people think about me and people who look like me is not true. And I feel like sitting at John's table, that preemie paused and said, you know what? Maybe I've caught up.
Maybe caught up.
But to sit there as a black man and feel like I don't have to play catch up was redemptive. That was worth the Ancestry.com fee. That was worth the flights down to New Orleans. But to sit there and say, I'm good. I left that meeting and that space feeling completely comfortable in my own skin and knowing that for no money in the world would I trade being Henderson's son for being RL's son. And for that, in some ways, Charles, that was all the reparation that that table that Saturday in New Orleans could give me. And it was quite sufficient.
Reverend Alex G. He is the senior pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church and the CEO and founder of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development in Madison, Wisconsin. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And by the way, you can see the photo album of Reverend G's trip, including some of those historical photos, on our website at dtbook.org. And coming up,
we're going to head up this way up the hill here. Okay. We got a ways to go, just so you're aware.
Okay, it's good to know.
Steve Paulson never met a graveyard he didn't want to visit.
It's a good day for it.
Yeah, it's clear. Cold day.
Yeah.
Today he's hunting for one very special, very elusive grave.
I think that's John's. And then one of these will be Beverly's as well. Oh, this is Thomas.
And it's not the big stone here.
Nope, this is Julia. That's his wife. His kids are all here.
Esten is buried here, isn't he?
I would assume he is.
Looking for America's racial history in a graveyard. Next. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's back here somewhere.
And PRX. We left Steve Paulson in the middle of Madison's Forest Hill Cemetery. At least it was a beautiful day.
It's quite beautiful with the snow covering here.
Isn't it? It's really peaceful and lovely.
He's with local historian Aaron Hoag, and they're looking for one grave.
Yeah, it's distinctly possible. It's just so buried we can't see it.
Yeah.
Esten Hemings Jefferson.
I'm going to rub off the snow here to see him. And this is, I think, the family marker you're looking for.
Oh.
If you don't know who that is, he was the son of our third president, his black son. Like a lot of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. And with one of them, her name was Sally Hemings, he had children. So how did one of them wind up in a Wisconsin graveyard? Well, that story is like a giant metaphor for America's tangled racial roots.
Esten Hemings Jefferson was the youngest son of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. He came to Madison, well, it would have been right after the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act. So we should go back a little bit in time. After Thomas Jefferson died, he granted all of his children their freedom, as was Sally Hemings' freedom.
They grew up slaves. On Monticello, on Jefferson's plantation. And then once they are freed, some of them identified as African-American. Others passed because they had light enough skin.
They were all fairly fair-skinned. They could pass. Even Julia Esten's wife was also multiracial, and so she could also pass as white. They were in the census in 1850 in Ohio identified as mulatto, but then after the Fugitive Slave Act passed in 1850, Esten and Julia decided to take their three kids and move further north away from the border, and they moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and here they passed as white, and they identified as white. They lived among white society. Nobody ever questioned that, and that is how they continued their life. John and Beverly, who are Esten's two sons, both served in the Civil War. They served in Wisconsin regiments. At the time of the Civil War, if you were African American and identified that way, you had to be in a colored regiment. Both of them served in white regiments. So clearly there was no question that they were white and that they identified that way. After the war, John, the older one, he moved to Memphis and became a cotton shipper, was very successful at it, but never married. There's some theories that he chose not to because if he had a child who was dark-skinned, that would sort of blow his cover, I guess, in a manner of speaking, and then he could lose everything. Beverly did marry. He had sons of his own. He stayed in Madison. He ran a very successful large carriage company here and purchased the first omnibus in Madison, actually.
So these children of a former slave became these prosperous businessmen right. in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, they did. And I have no idea why they chose Madison. One would assume maybe it had something to do with the name. You know, it was also obviously further north, certainly safer from the Fugitive Slave Act.
When I first heard that one of the children of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings was buried a half a mile from where I live, I was stunned. I mean, this is a long way from Monticello, Virginia, where
right.
he grew up.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. And actually, I didn't know it until I was on our cemetery tours. And one of my coworkers pointed this out. And I said, I'm sorry, who? They're all over the Midwest. There are still family members in Michigan, still some in Ohio. They all just kind of progressively moved to the middle and north of the United States.
Just thinking about the history of this. I mean, so you have mm-hmm. the son of Jefferson, the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, and then you have a child who grew up in slavery. It's like these threads of American history come together right here in this cemetery.
Right. It's interesting how little you sort of know about your local history and how it all kind of intersects in various ways, and it still affects us today. Thomas Jefferson is so famous, right? And he stands for so many things. I don't think you can avoid kind of feeling the weight of that here.
Aaron Hoag is an education specialist with the Wisconsin Veterans Museum here in Madison. So by now, pretty much everyone knows that Thomas Jefferson had a sexual relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings, and that they had children. But 20 years ago, the Jefferson-Hemings relationship was mostly a rumor that his white descendants denied. And then, a brilliant legal scholar, Annette Gordon Reed, proved it with historical records, stories passed down by Sally Hemings' children, even DNA evidence. She became the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize for History, followed by a MacArthur Genius Award. And she told Steve Paulson this story is a perfect example of the way many Americans have tried to bury and deny the real history of slavery.
I think most people in the black community did not doubt it because we understand that this kind of thing happened quite a bit. And so it didn't seem like it was wild and crazy. I would say that most historians did not believe it was true. And there were a variety of reasons. There was sort of an old view, well, Jefferson was a Southern gentleman, and this sort of...
He wouldn't do this.
He wouldn't do this. There was this sort of treacly treatment of Southern life, you know, moonlight and magnolias and honor and all that kind of stuff, which is not real. All those kinds of things are based upon lies, obviously. But then there were also people who felt that he was too racist to have been involved in a long-term liaison with a, whatever you want to call it, relationship connection with an African-American woman. So it was either he was too honorable or he was too racist.
Hmm. Well, we should give a brief sketch, a brief history of what mm-hmm. we know about the connection between mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. So it started in Paris, right? When mm-hmm. Jefferson went over to Paris and he was what, ambassador?
He went over for a diplomatic mission. Jefferson went over in 1784 and he took his eldest daughter, Martha, called Patsy and James Hemings, who was Sally Hemings, one of her older brothers. And he took James over to have him trained as a chef. Jefferson liked French cooking, and he wanted his own chef at Monticello. He left behind two of his daughters and Sally Hemings, who was the companion to these girls. They were all children, basically. Sally Hemings is only a few years older at this time than these girls. During the time that Jefferson is there, the younger daughter dies, and Jefferson, at this point, is determined to have his other daughter brought to him. But he asks for her to come over with, he says, a careful Negro woman. Instead, Jefferson's sister-in-law, who in this convoluted story was also Sally Hemings' half-sister, because Jefferson's wife and Sally Hemings were half-sisters. They had the same father,
John Wales. The same white father.
The same white father, John Wales. And they sent her over, and Sally Hemings is 14 at this time, and Polly, the younger daughter, is about 9. So she is the sort of caretaker, companion slash to Polly. And at some point during this time period, Madison Hemings said his mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine. It's sort of interesting because everybody called him Mr. Jefferson when they were speaking to other people. And France was not free soil in the sense that you set foot in France and you were immediately free, but everybody who petitioned for freedom in France had the petition granted. So James and Sally Hemings could have remained there, and they thought about doing it.
This is fascinating. I mean, yeah. So they are slaves
back in Virginia.
Back in Virginia, and yeah. But in Paris, presumably, they just need to petition for their freedom, and they could be free.
They could be free people. And I think Jefferson was on the defensive about this because he does something that he continues later on, but he pays them wages while they're there. One of the things I'll never know, obviously, but I'd like to know how they presented themselves, because these are two people who might have been able to pass for white.
They were light-skinned.
They're light-skinned people, and they could well have presented themselves as just servants to Jefferson without this other overlay of slavery. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they could have had that. Jefferson, according to Madison Hemings, wanted Sally Hemings to come back with him and promised her that she would have a nice life at Monticello and that their children would be freed when they were 21.
And, of course, the other side of this is by the time they go back to America, Sally Hemings is pregnant.
Yes.
With Jefferson's child, mm-hmm. and she's 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's she going to do, I suppose, if she stays in Paris? I mean, that would be pretty tough.
It will be tough, but if she were there with James, I know someone is actually working on a sort of alternative novel about Sally Hemings staying there. One of the things that could have happened is that she could have stayed there with Jefferson's secretary, William Short, who was anti-slavery, who remained in Paris and remained in Europe for a number of years. You know, she could have been a maid to him. James could have been the cook for him. Yes, it would have been tough, but, you know, it could have been tough back at Monticello if he hadn't. Jefferson could have reneged on everything. He could have died.
At least according to Madison Hemings, the mm-hmm. son who later wrote about mm-hmm. this. I mean, mm-hmm. after talking with his mother, Sally and James sort of extracted promises from Jefferson that they would be treated differently once they go back.
Well, Sally certainly did. That was the condition. Madison Hemings said that was a condition on which his mother came back. She would be treated well, and her children would be free. And so they come back to Monticello. The sons are put under the tutelage of one of her brothers, John Hemings, who is a master carpenter at Monticello.
And how many children did she have?
She had 7 children, but only 4 of them lived to adulthood, mm-hmm. which was sort of a thing that happened.
And as far as we know, Thomas Jefferson was the father of all of them.
As far as we know, the father of all of them. And that's what Madison Hemings says and Israel Gillette Jefferson says. And then the DNA, it's corroborating. It's not a strict paternity test. But when you look at anything, it's a compilation of evidence. It's not any one killer thing.
What did people say about Sally Hemings? How did people describe her?
Well, they didn't say much. Most of the descriptions of her are physical descriptions. People describe her as being very beautiful. That was the thing that people fixated on. One newspaper report, when the scandal broke, described her as, someone said that she was industrious and orderly.
Now, when you said the scandal broke, some of Jefferson's political enemies heard about this, and they tried to make hay about it.
Absolutely.
Look what Jefferson has, the scandal in his own family.
Mm-hmm. It caused a real stir. It sort of spread everywhere. It didn't really affect Jefferson's career, I mean, in the sense that he was reelected resoundingly.
And maybe some people reacted that way because it actually was not that uncommon.
No. Yeah, certainly people in the South understood that this kind of thing happened. Jefferson had a reputation, however, of this sort of philosopher. You know, the stereotypes that people have. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're really intellectual, you know, you're not interested in...
In sex.
I mean, which is ridiculous. But right. 18th century people were not prudes. People had sex and they had a different attitude about sex. The Victorian age comes later. These people were not Victorians. But I think realistically people thought this is the South. This is what happens mm-hmm. when men are in control of women.
So how would you describe this relationship between Jefferson and, I mean, the question is, what word do we use? I mean, you mentioned that, that their son, Madison Hemings, referred to his mother as Jefferson's concubine. The word mistress has been used to describe mm-hmm, her. Mm-hmm. Is there an appropriate word here?
Well, the word concubine, I actually went back and looked at legal cases. White women were referred to as concubines. A concubine was a person who lived with a man without being married, period. That's what it was. And there are some cases when the men married the women. So you can go from concubine to being wife.
And we should point out that Jefferson's wife had died.
Oh, yes. Jefferson's wife
is dead. Before any of this happened.
Yeah, Jefferson's wife died in 1782. And the Hemings women tell the story that when she was on her deathbed, she asked Jefferson not to remarry. The Hemings women say that she said she did not want another woman over her children. They said Jefferson agreed to that. So she died. He was 39 years old, and he died when he was 83. He never remarried. That's a long time.
And apparently, I mean, this relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings went on for a long time, for years and years.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The span of her childbearing is basically 20 years. So you can only say that's the definite time period where you know for a fact they're having sex. But she was his chambermaid until he died. So he arranged their lives so that she was in it all the time, basically, for 38 years. The Hemings family oral history talks about how he felt about her. One of Madison's granddaughters said, Mr. Jefferson loved her dearly. But he doesn't talk about how she felt about him.
Because, so, I mean, that is the question a lot of people ask. Did they love each other?
Yeah, people ask me that all the time, and there's no real way to know that, the answer to that.
Is that a legitimate question to ask if we're talking about a master-slave relationship?
Well, a lot of people think it's not an appropriate question to ask because it's not possible for that to be. But I don't subscribe to that because human beings do all kinds of things that they shouldn't do. You know, I might say I could list all the reasons why you shouldn't feel that way, but that doesn't have anything to do with the way human beings live in the world. I think that's largely a political judgment. A sort of after-the-fact political judgment about how uncomfortable we are with this idea. Madison Hemings talks about them in the recollections. He clearly is talking about them as if they are a family. And that's kind of jolting in a way.
Sally and her children were treated very differently than the other slaves on Jefferson Plantation, right?
Yes. Madison Hemings says that they were happy growing up because they knew they were not going to be slaves all their lives.
What eventually happened to the children who did survive into adulthood of Sally and Tom?
Well, Beverly is a male, and his sister Harriet, those are the two oldest children, they left Monticello to live as white people. They don't have freedom papers, and you can see why they don't want them, because if they had freedom papers, people would know that they were part black because they'd been enslaved, and you'd be able to trace them. One reason we don't know about their descendants is because they have no paper trail. We know about Madison and Esten, and that's the thing about documents. That's the importance of them. Once you put things down in writing, you can at least begin to locate where people are and then research and find out about them.
So the big question that people have been asking for decades is, what do we make of Thomas Jefferson? This revered founding father who wrote the major part of the Declaration of Independence saying that all men are created equal, you know, the great document of freedom and equality, who was not just a slave owner, but had this intimate relationship with this slave woman for years and had children together. I mean, what do we do with
that? Well, that kind of thing was a part of being a slave owner. I mean, the real problem with Jefferson is the connection to slavery. And we've always known that. But I think what is happening now is people are understanding that slavery was not just about making people work for no money or whipping people or whatever. It was an institution that ended up with mixed bloodlines in a lot of different ways, through rape, through connections that we don't understand and that make us uncomfortable. I think the thing to make of it is that Jefferson was a person.
We should take him down from the mountain as this revered icon.
No, there are things to admire about Jefferson. And we're just going to have to grapple with the fact that a person who wrote the Declaration of Independence and helped create the country, not just Jefferson, but Washington and all of them, a number of them were slaveholders. They held people in bondage and profited from that. I think you have to take the bitter with the sweet. And I don't know that it's ever good to revere people as gods in a way, because they're always going to disappoint you. I think a better way to look at it is to say, this is what these human beings did on their time on Earth. And some of it was good and some of it was bad. And what can we live with and what things do we reject? How do we move on from that? Jefferson didn't think that we were going to stay in one place.
But he had a pretty pessimistic view of race relations, didn't he? I mean, he was racist.
Yeah,
He thought black people were inferior, were not as smart as white people.
And that's what most people at that time thought, and that's what a lot of people think today. There's no question about that, even though he says, I venture it as a suspicion only. But it's not a suspicion. He believed that whites were better than blacks. That was the currency of the time. I do think he thought slavery was wrong, but it's like many other things that we believe that we don't live by. This was not what really animated Jefferson. I mean, we're interested in slavery and race, and we should be, but that's not the main thing he was interested in. He was interested in the United States of America. He'd been part of a revolution that overthrew a king and created a new society. That's what he was fixated on. That slavery thing, that'll solve itself. But it's like many things in life. You say, if I could just fix this, that little thing over there, it'll be fine. But it's that little thing over there that destroys the thing that you love.
Yeah.
And slavery was, he came to see, the rock upon which the Union will be split. And that was true.
Yeah. Thank you very much. This is just a fascinating history.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Harvard legal historian Annette Gordon-Reed talking with Steve Paulson. Her book, The Hemingses of Monticello, won a Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. So today, you don't have to go digging in libraries to find your roots. With genetic ancestry testing, all you need is a drop of spit and a test tube. And in one college classroom, that's how the semester begins.
For the past 12 years, I have had people actually take the DNA ancestry test and both look at the diversity within and then how that connects you to other people you've might not have thought you were connected to in the past. We reveal on a day all together and then have a discussion, and it's always fascinating. We hand out the results in an envelope or in a folder. We say, you know, now go ahead and open them. You're looking at a pie chart. It takes a minute to process what you're seeing. And then you start to hear the responses. Somebody goes, yes. Somebody else goes, I can't believe this. Where did this come from? What is that? The results are in. Let the outrage begin.
Next, how genetic testing is changing conversations about race. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX. Thank you.
This hour, we've been talking about how the legacy of slavery lives on not just in history books, not just in our laws and institutions and communities, but in our blood. So what changes when you realize your own genetic ancestry is both black and white, African and European? Well, at Westchester University in Pennsylvania, Anita Foman leads the DNA Discussion Project. Every semester, students in her class take a genetic ancestry test. And she says the results can change the stories they tell about themselves and others, often in profound ways.
I started 12 years ago when somebody said, I think I read an article that said you could trace somebody's ancestry based on their DNA. And I thought, boy, I bet that there are a lot of people walking around thinking their backgrounds are one thing and they're different. And how would that change the conversation that we had about race?
Paint me a picture of this. You have a class full of undergraduate kids and they all spit in a test tube and send it away. And is there a big unveiling day when they get their results?
Yes. And almost invariably, there's something there that is unexpected. And people are funny. It really runs the gamut. Somebody will say the test is not right, you know, test it over. But they also start to see that they're connected to people that they did not think they were connected to. And it's really neat. In one setting, there was a young white guy who had 2 or 3% African in his background. He was sitting next to two African-American gentlemen, and they wanted to high-five him. And you saw him sort of reflecting, am I high-fiving here? Is this appropriate?
Have you gone through your own genetic testing?
I have. It took me 10 years to do it.
You're kidding.
And I said, what would Freud say? And indeed, found some things I expected and some things that I didn't expect.
Like what?
I was surprised how much European, I'm African American. I was surprised how much European was in my background. 25% European, which floored me. The most stunning experience that I had was that I went to Ghana several years before I took the test. And as part of that trip, we went to a place called the Door of No Return, which is where the slaves went out on the ships and just never returned. And so when I looked at my profile, I had significant Ghana in my background. Oh. And I thought, oh my goodness, one of my relatives literally probably went through that door. And I was surprised at my own reaction. And I've heard other people say that they have been surprised at their own reaction.
Surprised how?
Just how emotional that was for me. And I think that that is something that a lot of African Americans experience. It's hard to articulate it. It's sort of a low-level anxiety. Just this tremendous feeling of sadness. As a person who has a background in slavery, where you were systematically told that you were just not fully human, to face that directly by looking at my DNA was very potent for me.
I just imagine that there must be such a mixed range of emotions. You know, on the one hand, maybe there's some real joy in discovering your African roots, which particular parts of Africa, being able to really connect viscerally. And at the same time, you know, as you said, it makes that legacy of slavery really personal.
Everybody's history is complex, though. You do not survive from the beginning of time without a very complicated story. I mean, we grapple over who's oppressed and who's the oppressor. If you dig back into your past, you have both. Your genes hold a very complicated story. So when I hear somebody who's African American make the statement that we were raped by them, genetically, you carry both of those, and your genes do not care what the backstory is.
But then what do you do with that if you think 25% or whatever portion of your genetic heritage is European, and you know that your ancestors probably were raped by slave traders or owners? What do you do with that?
Well, so you can also say some of my ancestors were rapists. That's what I'm saying, that genetically, I wouldn't be here if anything had been different in any way. I was surprised, and many people are surprised, how much Scandinavian is in their background because I had British and Scandinavian. Well, a lot of that is, you know, the Vikings beating up the British, you know.
Wow.
And so there is history that's carried in those genes. That's really what this project is about not seeing race as something that pits you against me, but something that tells a story. And it gives us an opportunity that we had not had before to see ourselves as just deeply connected at the most fundamental level.
Now, I think many, if not most, white Americans grow up believing their ancestry is 100% European. In your experience, how frequently do students discover that they're multiracial?
We've been doing statistical analysis, and the group that is most likely to overestimate their background are whites. Whites will generally say, I have 100% European.
Mm-hmm.
And often they will be predominantly European, but there are other things in their background. And even if somebody has 2, 3, 4, 5%, they are completely flabbergasted. One gentleman who was really interesting, a white guy, said that there had been a story in his family that his great-grandmother was black and that she had given away his grandfather so that he would have a better life. He was biracial, and that he had seen her only once in life, and it was under these clandestine circumstances. And indeed, we tested him, and he had 3% African ancestry, which would be consistent with that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, people have these percentages, and there isn't a narrative. And it's not surprising, because look at the history, in particular, of the United States, where one drop of blood, and so if somebody was light, they, quote, passed. They lied about it.
So does this open the door to interesting conversations when the kids go back home?
Oh, yes. Sometimes stories tumble out that they hadn't expected. One gentleman took the test. It was really funny. Many people will say they have Native American in their background, which whites and blacks overestimate the Native American in their background, which is interesting because they have these romantic images of Native Americans and think about the real story of how Native Americans were treated. But at any rate, there was a gentleman who said he had Native American in his background. The evidence is always a woman with a long dark braid. So anyway, we test him. He comes up as 10% African. So he goes back to his family, and I said, God bless him. His family said, maybe she was black. So,
but I can imagine that this might play out in a class, like maybe a kid who has identified as 100% white European discovers that she's got some African ancestry. Maybe it's an uncomfortable kind of situation for her. I can imagine a kid sitting next to her who's African American might be really offended and say, what, you're not happy to have African blood? Are you racist?
Yeah, and I certainly understand why somebody who identifies as white is going to find it upsetting if they find African in their background. For heaven's sakes, look at how African Americans have been treated in this country, legally and socially. To delve into that, that's a real learning experience. What are their beliefs? Might there have been somebody in their background who hid that for particular reasons? And, you know, how do we move forward with that? So it happens, and not just with African ancestry, Middle Eastern. One fellow in a class had 2 or 3% Middle Eastern. His family was up in arms about it.
So what kind of conversations do you have in classrooms after the students get their results? And what do they wind up talking about with each other? Because the revelation is just the beginning.
The interesting thing is that over time, people start to talk about race differently. You see a younger generation already being more flexible. And again, in our research, we found that older people were more rigid about their backgrounds. I'm black, I'm white, whatever. Younger people were much more fluid in terms of how they saw race and how they saw their racial identity. And so we see these genetic tests as really just another element of making race more fluid and allowing people to live with more ambiguity around race. Younger people, for a variety of reasons, and these genetic tests are just part of it, are much more comfortable with ambiguity, with contested race and with having this conversation.
Have you noticed that young people are happy to discover that they're multiracial?
Yes, much more so. We'll have young people test and often say, I thought I was going to have more stuff than that. You know, they'll be disappointed that they don't have something. And we even did one project with children who were, I think the youngest was 9 years old. One of the questions was, what would you like to have in your ancestry? What would be the best background? And he said, I want everything.
Do you ever wonder what would happen if everybody just grew up knowing their genetic ancestry? Like, what if genetic testing was mandatory in first grade? What would that change about how we think and talk about race in this country?
I do think that we are going to get to a different place in talking about race. Now, given some of the things that are going on socially and politically, people say to me, how can you say that? But I think that some of the turmoil that we are experiencing right now is because things are changing and it's really hard for people. I think there's a point of panic before you break through to another level. And I think that there are enough good people who want to talk about these things, who want to figure out how we can live together. I don't think we have to give up our understanding of real histories that have occurred in the United States and globally. But I think that becomes part of a narrative that is not just the African-American narrative or the, you know, Italian. It's our narrative. It belongs to all of us so that when we look at our genes, we realize that people are our people.
Anita Fulman. She leads the DNA Discussion Project at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. And that's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. And if you want to find out more about the backstory to this show and all the behind-the-scenes research that went into it, sign up for our newsletter. It's full of extended written features, audio extras, and stuff about what we're reading. To subscribe, head over to ttbook.org/newsletter. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our show is produced by Charles Monroe Kane, Halima Shah, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for spending time with us.